KALW.
You know, she decided at some point to take a hard turn left, and she's completely turned her back on law enforcement.
When Kamala Harris left her post as California's attorney general to join the Senate, her political stances appeared to shift.
Watching her, that has informed me on a relationship building with our colleagues on both sides of the aisle.
Today, we're bringing you the final episode from the new podcast, Chronicled, Who is Kamala Harris?, about how her time in Washington catapulted her to the national stage. Then we'll hear about a documentary that explores the history and culture of vinyl records.
You know, they're big and they're beautiful. The artwork is really attractive, and it's a way to show, like, I'm so into this band that I own the record.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we're bringing you the final episode of a new series from the San Francisco Chronicle. It's a podcast called Chronicled, Who is Kamala Harris? And it looks at the life and career of the vice president-elect. When we left off, we were looking at Harris's run for president. Here's how she got from there to the top ticket in the country.
With her presidential campaign ended, Kamala Harris returned to the Senate in December of 2019 and voted to impeach Donald Trump in February. But the Republican-controlled chamber acquitted the president, as expected.
But we're not going to talk much about that, because bigger events were on the horizon.
In March of 2020, just after Joe Biden surged ahead of Bernie Sanders on Super Tuesday and took control of the Democratic primary race, the country shut down in response to the coronavirus pandemic. In May, protests erupted nationwide after a white Minneapolis police officer killed George Floyd, a black man, by kneeling on his neck for nearly 9 minutes during an arrest. Floyd's death came in the wake of the fatal shooting of black jogger Ahmaud Arbery by white residents in a Georgia suburb, and the Louisville police killing of Breonna Taylor, a black woman, in her home. Though their deaths had happened in February and March, they were slower to gain national attention. Floyd's death in particular set off the wave of protests, which were built on the pain of all three killings. Kamala Harris became a leader of Democrats' efforts to draft police reform legislation. She also became a loud voice on the disproportionate effect the pandemic was having on black and brown communities at the same time.
She said her law enforcement background uniquely positioned her to be a reformer. But to some who knew her when she referred to herself as the top cop in San Francisco, the change was startling. This is Gary Delanis, the former head of the San Francisco Police Union that endorsed Harris in her first race for district attorney. We've heard from him in earlier episodes.
You know, she decided at some point to take a hard turn left. Obviously, in my opinion, trying to appeal to the far left of the Democratic Party. And she's completely turned her back on law enforcement and basically thrown law enforcement under the bus for political gain. I mean, that's my opinion.
Speculation that Biden would name her as his running mate intensified, and so did the spotlight on the glaring lack of people of color in national politics. Kamala Harris was about to hit the campaign trail again.
Yes or no?
Daughter of Oakland, California.
Sir, I'm asking a question.
I say we fight.
And that little girl was me.
I'm Joe Garofoli.
And I'm Tal Copen. And this is Chronicled. Who is Kamala Harris? Episode 6, I'm Speaking. A particularly salient moment happened in June. On the day of Floyd's memorial service, the staffs of Kamala Harris and her friend and fellow Black Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey got word of a development on legislation they had written to make lynching a federal crime for the first time in American history. The bill had passed the Senate unanimously the previous year, but a slight change in the House meant the Senate had to pass it again. And this time, Kentucky Republican Rand Paul was objecting unless the Senate adopted his amendment to narrow the definition of lynching to only the most extreme acts of mutilation.
There was no understanding that that was going to be the day that this happened. Both she and I just found out an hour or so before that Rand Paul was trying to do this.
To suggest that lynching would only be a lynching if someone's heart was pulled out and produced and displayed to someone else is ridiculous. And on this day, the day of George Floyd's funeral, on this day, a day that should be a day of national mourning.
And I think both of us, when we got down there, I still remember what I said to her, which was a little off color, so I won't say it on a podcast, but I just said it was the wrong day to mess with me, basically.
Our bill is an opportunity to right a wrong and an opportunity for a reckoning in federal law. And we cannot pretend that lynchings are a thing of the past.
It was really one of those just more raw, visceral fights from both of us that you're tired of having to do in your life. But here we are on the floor of the United States Senate, where there never was before a black woman and a black man standing together like that, and having to fight a battle that should have been settled a century before.
So it is remarkable and it is painful to be standing here right now, especially when people of all races are marching in the streets of America, outraged by the hate and the violence and the murder that has been fueled by racism during the span of this country's life.
The bill still has not passed into law. That day exemplified so much about Kamala Harris's career. The difficulty of passing even inoffensive legislation into law in today's Washington, especially as a junior member of the minority party, and the pain, pressure, and power of being the only one like you in the room. Mazie Hirono of Hawaii says it's something she's also felt as one of the only immigrants in the Senate, especially when you speak about your own experiences with injustice and still get pushback from a white colleague.
I think that was a particularly painful experience that Kamala had, because we have had systemic racism in our country. So, yes, a lot of us bring very personal experiences to bear on our deliberations. And it is painful when others obviously don't share that experience or try to correct you. My goodness, how dare they? You just want to say to them, just shut up.
Joe Biden had pledged to name a woman as his running mate, and now some were pressuring him to pick a woman of color. Some activists have been wanting that for a long time.
What is important about there being a black woman in particular, not just a woman of color, is that, you know, black voters are who essentially made Joe Biden the presumptive nominee.
That's Alicia Garza, the co-creator of Black Lives Matter, on my It's All Political podcast this summer, back when Biden was deciding who to choose as his running mate. She pointed out that it was black voters who helped Biden win the South Carolina primary and turn around his campaign when it was floundering. Multiple names surfaced as trial balloons. Former UN Ambassador Susan Rice, Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, Los Angeles Representative Karen Bass, who worked with Harris on the Democrats' police reform bill, but all quickly fell back to earth. Ultimately, it came back to the speculation from the spring of 2019.
You ready to go to work?
Oh my God, I'm so ready to go to work.
Kamala Harris was the last one standing. One of the key factors? Her long friendship with Beau Biden, Joe's son, who passed away from brain cancer in 2015. Beau was Delaware's attorney general at the same time that Kamala Harris was serving in California. In a recent fundraiser, Joe Biden said it was Beau who introduced him to Harris for the first time. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto was AG of Nevada at the same time.
As part of the AG world, Beau was so well respected. He was open, he was friendly, he cared, he was committed, and he just always had a positive attitude. And that's the Beau Biden we all got to know when we started working together. I cherish the relationship that I had with Beau. I know Kamala does the same.
Senators Cortez Masto, Hirono, and Booker all say that their colleague's ability to build relationships is one of her greatest attributes, one that Americans may not often be able to see.
When we first got here to the Senate, unbeknownst to both of us, the women of the Senate actually get together and have dinner. They try to do it once a month. And so that first month we got here, we got invited to a dinner put together by the women senators, bipartisan. And they invited former female senators, women senators to come to the dinner. And that is a tradition. And I think we both thought, wow, this is fantastic. And I think watching her and that has informed me on a relationship building, watching her as she builds those relationships with our colleagues on both sides of the aisle.
Even Kamala Harris's Republican colleagues acknowledge her skills. In late 2018 and early 2019, when I was working on a story about her time in the Senate, I spoke to as many as I could about her record. Here's what they told me then in the hallways of the Capitol. James Lankford of Oklahoma.
We were in Afghanistan. We're in a lot of pretty intense conversations with a lot of folks that are on the ground. And she's a good listener, good question asker, extremely personable, which is friendly to everybody.
Chuck Grassley of Iowa.
She's quite a fighter. We saw that between me and her on the Kavanaugh hearings. And she's always treated me fairly. And I'd say even treating me fairly, considering how the meeting on Kavanaugh started out. But there's no long-lasting irritation on my part about that, because I knew they were doing what they felt strongly about.
Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
She's really smart. People like her. You know, some of the Kavanaugh stuff wasn't my cup of tea, but I think she's very bright. Has a good personality. Anybody who underestimates her will do so at their own peril.
Let's flash forward to just a few weeks ago. It's early October, and President Trump and Joe Biden have just had an unruly debate that Trump made unlistenable with his constant interruptions. Then Trump is diagnosed with the coronavirus, and any future debates are in doubt. We arrive at the date that political junkies had long circled on their calendar, October 7th, the only vice presidential debate. Kamala Harris's reputation precedes her, but so does that of Vice President Mike Pence, a silver-tongued former radio host. Even Trump has marveled about his remarkable ability to evade questions. It's the prize fight of the election cycle for many, even if it's on the undercard. And it raises many of the same recurring themes for Kamala Harris, being questioned about what she truly stands for and making sure her voice is heard.
And Senator Harris.
People, Susan, are voting right now. They'd like to know if you and Joe Biden are going to pack the Supreme Court if you don't get your way in this nomination.
Let's talk about packing.
You once again gave a non-answer. Joe Biden gave a non-answer.
I'm trying to answer you
now.
The
American people deserve a straight answer. And if you haven't figured it out yet, the straight answer is they are going to pack the Supreme Court if they somehow win this election.
Yeah, let's talk about packing the court then. Let's talk about the
fact.
Yeah, I'm about to.
And I must tell you, this presumption that you hear consistently from Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, that America is systemically racist. And that, as Joe Biden said, that he believes that law enforcement has an implicit bias against minorities, is a great insult to the men and women who serve in law enforcement.
I will not sit here and be lectured by the vice president on what it means to enforce the laws of our country. I am the only one on this stage who has personally prosecuted everything from child sexual assault to homicide.
And it all built up to...
Well, let's get...
This is important. Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking.
It was the I'm speaking heard round the world. Once again, T-shirts were made. The moment achieved a pop culture milestone. It was part of a Saturday Night Live cold open.
And while he speaks, I'm going to smile at him like I'm in a TJ Maxx and a white lady asked me if I work here.
Kamala Harris's repeated use of I'm speaking.
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking. Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking. I'm speaking.
Well, I'd like you to answer the question.
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking.
And a fly that sat on Mike Pence's head for 2 minutes, but we don't have audio of that. Those were the lasting memories of the VP debate. But mainly, a black woman holding her own.
There's no doubt Kamala Harris is a key piece of Joe Biden's campaign. But her next step rests on his success or failure. The question she's faced throughout her career won't end on November 3rd, 2020. Remember Gary Delanis, the police union leader who met Harris more than 17 years ago when she was running for her first campaign? Here's how he put it.
I was surprised at how hard left she went. And it did seem to hurt her in the presidential election, but she's resurfaced, and who knows, she could be the president of the United States someday.
Or, at the moment, the next vice president. If that happens, Cory Booker might once again find himself the lone black Democratic senator.
I think this is what I will miss so much about her, should she, God willing, be the next vice president. She and I could just often, with just a look, feel each other. You know, I will really miss having my friend there with me.
That was the final episode of the podcast chronicled Who is Kamala Harris from the San Francisco Chronicle. It aired just about a month ago, and since then, Harris has in fact become the vice president-elect of the United States. Chronicled is reported by Joe Garofoli and Tal Copen, produced by King Kaufman. Find out how to subscribe to hear every episode in the series. Go to klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Records have made a comeback. Actually, they never quite went away, but they're popular again. Business Insider reports that vinyl records are outselling CDs for the first time since the 1980s. In the first half of the year, U.S. record sales totaled $232 million. So why are people turning to their turntables for music? The documentary Vinyl Nation explores that question. The film looks at the history of records and current culture of vinyl buyers. Directors Kevin Smokler and Christopher Boone went to record stores around the country. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with the filmmakers.
Whose great idea was this?
This is Kevin. I brought the idea to Chris about 2 years ago because we had gone to college together in the 17th century. And the idea was like, okay, records are experiencing a comeback. More importantly is what does it mean? Like, what does it mean spiritually, politically, culturally? What does it say about our relationship to music and to each other?
Well, I'll start with you, Christopher. Do you collect vinyl?
I do, but I got into it later than Kevin. Kevin got into it, I think around 2007, you would say, Kevin. I got into it about 2014, but I got into it when my wife actually made the mistake of buying a turntable for us. And that just kind of opened the floodgates. When Kevin brought the idea to me, I was interested in pursuing it because I have a daughter who's now 17. And she started collecting her own records. And I just really thought it was fascinating that young people who have only known music through iTunes and Spotify are now discovering records.
Did she say why she was in a record?
Like, it doesn't blow their mind that a phone can just play things back to them at the touch of the screen or button. Like, who cares about that? But actually seeing like a record work and music come out from it, like, that's amazing. But also, you know, they're big and they're beautiful. The artwork is really attractive. And it's a way to show, like, I'm so into this artist or this band that I own the record.
This boom, this interest in records, it was because of Record Day?
Yeah, so Record Store Day started from a meeting down in Baltimore, a conference amongst a bunch of record store owners called Noise in the Basement. And Brian Burkert, who's one of the owners of the Soundgarden in Baltimore, spearheaded that campaign, because the idea was, you know, these record stores, as you were mentioning, were closing, and they took a page out of the comic book store, where they're doing like free comic book day. And they're like, is there a way we could do that? And so they thought we could have record store day, but they're like, well, what is going to get people to come to record stores? Like, what's going to make it special? And they realized, you know what, we could make vinyl records something special if we can get maybe some exclusive releases to come out. So they approached a handful of big name artists and said, would you get behind this? And they're like, yeah, because I love record stores and I don't want to see them go away. And Warner Brothers Records got behind it that first year too. So I think there were about like 30 or 35 artists, including Metallica and the Rolling Stones in that first year. And lo and behold, people came out and it was like, yeah, this is a lot of fun. And Record Store Day is the biggest event of the year for record stores. It's bigger than their Black Friday. It is the day where it kind of makes or breaks a record store, essentially, for those that participate. But really, the whole day is about coming out to the record store, seeing friends. And, you know, without that, honestly, I don't know if the comeback of vinyl happens, to be honest. And we might just be sitting in a streaming world right now. So that would be really sad.
who's part of Vinyl Nation? You know, I was really surprised that, like, there was this idea that it wasn't diverse. I grew up around records. Like, to this day, when my family, we all get together, we put on the record player.
Yeah. So when we started this movie, Chris and I were pretty convinced that this image in popular culture of record people was probably out of date. And we're like, okay, like if that conclusion means anything, everybody we talk to can't be that person. It can't look like the comic book store guy in The Simpsons. And then when we talked to Oliver Wang, who is a great music scholar based in Los Angeles, but who has a long history in the Bay Area, he's like, you know what? It's never been that person, or it's never been only that person. Record people are everybody, and they always have been.
Visually, the film is beautiful. And even, like, there was one scene where the record was melted, and which would suck if that was your record. But even you made that look pretty. Talk about the cinematography.
Yeah, we owe a lot to our cinematographer, Sherry Calk. She is amazing. And I'm a process geek. So we shot at 4 different record pressing plants. And for me, that was some of the most fun to get in there and see how records are made.
And the machines were old. You know, there was even just a vintageness to that, to the machines. What was it like witnessing that and watching that?
We understood in a very abstract way that it is factory work. It is industrial work. But there is no other way to make records. You really cannot automate the making of records in a way because the record itself is such a thin, fragile thing. We are not at the point yet where the ecosystem has caught up with the demand. So there are still way, way more people who want records and record labels who want to put them out and music artists who want to press their music on vinyl than there are enough machines and factories to make vinyl.
There's this romanticization of records, but records, they're not perfect. And you talk about that records can be a pain in the bleep.
Yeah, there are so many drawbacks to records, let's be honest. And they're heavy, they're cumbersome, they're easy to break, they're easy to scratch, they warp. It's just all these things about them that make them so great also make them like they can drive you crazy. And then on top of that, from the manufacturing perspective, it's plastic. Let's face it. It was really important for us to talk with all the manufacturers about the environmental impact of making records. And it's great to learn that, you know, the excess PVC that gets cut off of records called flash, that all gets recycled. It gets turned into regrind and gets put back into other records.
Last question is, what do you think of the significance of your film? Because I know, too, like, you know, mental health came up in your film as far as how for some people records have been soothing for them, you know. What do you think about the significance of this film now during the pandemic?
That's such a good question. Yes, it is a movie about records, unquestionably. But bigger than that, we hope it is a movie about human connection. And we hope it is about a movie about how records are simply a round black plastic metaphor for the thing we all have in common. You know, music being the universal language is also... It also means we are probably more alike than we are different.
Those were filmmakers Kevin Smokler and Christopher Boone speaking with KELW's Janae Darden. Vinyl Nation is streaming now through November 30th, and proceeds from the streaming help your favorite record stores. Go to our website for all the details, kelw.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Annalise Finney, Andrew J.M. Garcia, Lisa Morehouse, Sonia Narung, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.